Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Saturday, January 21st, 2023. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at @realistreport. And you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit the Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I'm joined by Robert Stark, an independent journalist, author, and filmmaker based in California. All right, Robert Stark, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Great being on your show.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. You maintain an excellent Substack page that I follow called Robert Stark's Newsletter, and I also see your articles published by the UNS Review, which is one of the top alternative media sites on the internet.
Oh, yeah. So with UNS, a lot of them recently they're mostly just reposts, but initially there was some original content that I had that was published on UNS.
Okay, yeah.
Where else? One of them, I think, only one article on Tacky Mag a couple years ago.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I've followed your Substack for a while, and I've seen your articles on UNS Review as well, as I mentioned. But yeah, it looks like lately, anyways, looking at your archive on the website, it's mostly stuff directly from your Substack. So it's kind of just republished at the UNS Review, which is pretty, pretty common for that website. But anyways, you're a great writer, a lot of very, very interesting insights. And I want to talk specifically about an article that you recently published about white Californians, a very, very interesting, thought-provoking article. So to get started, since this is our first time speaking, can you just introduce yourself briefly? Tell us about your background and experience in the alternative media.
Yeah, let me see. So I'm a California native. I've been in alternative media for about well over a decade, including on. I've had my podcast, Dark Truth Radio, that's been going for roughly a decade. And recently, I haven't been podcasting as much, but I've been more focused on the writing.
Okay, very good. Did you ever have a show on the Voice of Reason radio network?
Yeah, that was ages ago.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, I thought you had to have been the same person, because I remember hearing your show back then. That was years ago. That's probably, what, like 2011 or 12 or something like that?
Yeah, I think like 2010 to 2012.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, I know you've been involved in the alternative media for a long time. And I kind of recently discovered your Substack page, and, you know, I've seen your work in the past, and you're a really good writer, a lot of really good insights. And as a native Californian, I find it fascinating because I actually moved to California. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the responses were pretty interesting, a pretty wide range of responses. I think some people, like, they really got the article and they said, this is totally spot on and no one else is making these points 100% right. And then I kind of got it from both sides, because I have the people that kind of smears are saying, like, oh, obviously, like, the usual stuff, this article, obviously a few people saying, oh, this article is racist and that's obviously expected. But then a lot of the comments from UNS, like from like the right wing, actually saying, like, attacking, or not attacking me, but just kind of, like, I have a few kind of kooky comments saying that I have some, like, ulterior motive, but I think mostly, like, some right-wingers don't like it that I'm promoting, like, them for multiculturalism.
Yeah.
I'm actually, like, this is not true. I'm putting forth, like, positive forward-thinking alternatives, but I think right-wingers, they don't like it that I'm for multiculturalism. But I think the other thing is, some people were saying, I'm saying that I'm apologetic for the way things are going and the status quo. That's a critique that I've gotten from the right.
Well, I think you more or less accurately laid out what life is like in California, and I think so
yeah,
many.
Yeah, because that's the thing.
I
is,
think
I
so
think
many people.
That
People.
I said it's more bullying alone than American History X. I do think, like right wingers, their portrayal, they have some valid points, but I think the way. When by right wing, I mean both the mainstream right, that is like civic nationalism, and things like kind of more conservative. You have like conservatism, like the Epoch Times has a YouTube channel that talks about the decay of California, and then you have people who focus on the right wing more kind of like on race. But I think like the right wing, they're invested in these like narratives of conflict. And I don't know, because it's like they talk about California like it's this violent hellhole, and yeah, there's problems, but even with that, for the most part, like when I go out, like even in LA where there is major urban decay, I actually do feel like relatively safe. And I know I'm aware there is a rise in crime, and like you go to LA and you see these massive homeless encampments, but the right wing. Like they just have this narrative that California is just like it's just slums and violent crime everywhere, and I think they do like they do miss the mark of like what the real issues are.
Yes, I 100% agree with you. Well, you know what? Actually, as you're making these points, I actually want to ask you before we even jump into your article. In your Substack page, you describe yourself as a journalist, an author, and a documentary filmmaker who focuses on California issues, fusionist politics, and future trends. And this is kind of a general question, but I'm just curious. Can you kind of explain what you mean by fusionist politics, and like how would you overall just describe your racial or your political philosophy?
Yeah, I wrote that like such a long time ago. I was just thinking of something to write down. That was like I sort of wrote that before I started writing the Substack articles, so I can't really think of that. That's not like on the top of my mind, but I have written a number of articles. Like I would say, yeah, I would say that I'm not a right winger and I'm a nationalist. I think I tweeted kind of like half jokingly that like I said I'm a centrist and a multiculturalist, so no one can call me a racist. Kind of like half jokingly, but yeah, I would say that actually not to be like ironic or sarcastic, but actually that's true. I would say that I'm a centrist and a multiculturalist. Not a right winger or a nationalist.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. Well, it seems pretty clear based on a lot of your writings that you do view whites as under attack, and they need to essentially form a positive racial identity in order to survive. You know, in this post American system that we live in. Is that accurate? Fair to say?
I would say that's accurate. I guess the distinction is I would say. To pursue their interests within the framework as multiculturalists, not as nationalists. And the thing is, a lot of right wingers they hate to hear that. But the thing is, with multiculturalism, it you can operate under a kind of decentralized pro-life system. When if you say you're a nationalist, you're talking about this huge block of geography, of people, and of political power. And it becomes kind of like all or nothing. That's kind of the dichotomy. Like you're either a nationalist and this entire country is yours, or you just submit like defeat. And that's an insane, a really idiotic kind of dichotomy, which I think both sides, like basically everything in America's political paradigm is stuck in this dichotomy. It doesn't matter like the woke people, this kind of like colorblind kind of center, and like the right wing nationalist and civic nationalist people focused on like the race on the right wing, like they're all operating under this like same paradigm. And I think my position, maybe it's unique because of growing up in LA and kind of already a sort of like post-American environment, like that could be. But I do think like focusing Americanism as kind of an ideology, it sort of it impacts like all sides, and thinking about like multiculturalism, and I say symmetrical multiculturalism, which actually I think I forget who coined that term. It may have been James Lindsay is like more of a kind of like, I think it's James Lindsay. I'm not 100% sure. He's kind of like a colorblind, like classical liberal civic nationalist who's outspoken against like CRT and woke culture. But I think he's the one who maybe coined the term. He calls wokeness asymmetrical multiculturalism. So I've used the term like right-wing multiculturalism, but maybe I just say like symmetrical multiculturalism, because I also think with like the left, so like I have had people on the left have like smeared me and said nasty things, like the usual like smear of like racism. But I do think if you say you're for multiculturalism, it does kind of catch them off guard. Like it is, like semantics and the dialectics are very important.
Right. Wow. Well, you've definitely got a very unique outlook.
The side of that is, I think there are people on the right wing. If you say you're a multiculturalist, like they'll say like, "Oh, you're a right wing multiculturalist." That, like, they'll think it's some kind of like Jeb Bush, like kind of like conservative type thing. Like that's their response.
Right. But that's not really at all what you're.
No, it's
what
not.
You're, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's definitely a very unique insight. And I think, you know, your experience growing up in California, being a native Californian, you know, plays a lot into that. In the article that you wrote, it's just absolutely fascinating. It's what prompted me to reach out to you for this podcast. I originally caught it on your Substack page, but I know it's also posted at the UNS Review, as I mentioned. It's titled White Californians as a Prototype for America's Multi-Ethnic Future. And I just got to say right off the bat, I've always absolutely loved California, even growing up. I grew up in Nebraska, and I moved to California in 2009 after graduating from college, and I lived there for about 12 years, mostly in San Diego, but also about 5 years in Los Angeles area. And, you know, it's funny because everyone has an opinion about California, and usually it's not a very good opinion. And more often than not, the people holding these negative opinions about California have never even set foot in the state. And
that's 100% true.
Yeah.
California is, it's more like what it symbolizes to them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to be sure, and you talk about this in the article, and I obviously would not deny it. You've even mentioned it in this conversation so far. California does have a lot of very real problems: rising income inequality, huge cost of living expenses, and just unaffordable housing and real estate, massive homeless populations, especially in Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco, and white flight. I mean, the list goes on and on. But frankly, I mean, I've always found California to be an incredibly dynamic place.
I think I'll stand by this despite the problems. If you can afford to live here, I still think it's one of the greatest places in the world. Like even like just the geography. But I think it, like one point I made in the article is take an issue like white flight is I think the way like the right wing views like the issue of white flight, they think about conflict, but I think like the practical issues like housing supply and demand, and like the housing supply constrained by that. So you have a constrained housing supply, and then there's pressure from new immigration, and that's a far bigger issue. Just these like practical issues than these whole kind of like narratives about conflict that the right wing are invested in. Obviously, like social capital, a sense of community and identity, those are important issues. California is very like rootless and deracinated, and I think like what is more sensationalist to talk about? Maybe it's the truth that people don't, that maybe gets overlooked and neglected. But I do think both sides, like a lot of people who are just looking for like clickbait, or they want to promote their own narrative about like the right wing versus left wing culture war, are very invested in these narratives of conflict. And I think the other point I make is, so America as a whole does have major vulnerabilities with the economy and polarization, like this whole debt crisis. But I guess like, the other thing is like the whole kind of like collapse narrative. There are these, like, you can see these massive homeless encampments, and there's political corruption. But at the same time, like, I think like the right, the racial focus right, is maybe doesn't want to like admit this, but you can't. I think a lot of California is still an example of a very like diverse and transformed society that is still relatively functional and prosperous. And I think the right wing, the race focused right wing, doesn't want to. They're maybe uncomfortable with admitting that because it doesn't fit into their narrative of collapse.
Yeah, boy, that is so true. And I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, I've always found California to be an incredibly dynamic place. There's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of very productive businesses and economic activity. So, I mean, in that aspect, you know, I've never lived anywhere like that where, you know, there's so much going on in the state, no matter where you're at. At least in my experience, I mean, there's obviously a lot of rural parts of California that I didn't really experience. But like on the coast, like Southern California, certainly, you know, Northern California around San Francisco, there's just a lot going on, a lot of businesses, a lot of industry, a lot of very amazing, productive people and productive businesses, not to mention the incredible scenery, the weather, the beaches, the amazing outdoor experiences, the mountains. I mean, you know, it goes on and on. So there's a lot going on in California that California has a lot going on for. It's really a tragedy what's happened, you know, just even the years that I lived there, the 10 or 12 years that I lived there, you know, you can sign it. You kind of see things going downhill with the homeless problem, just, you know, increasing and exacerbating.
San Diego is considered like one of the more like nicer, cleaner cities. And I think even there, even San Diego, like downtown San Diego, the homeless crisis is pretty bad.
It is.
I think there's like one YouTube channel named like Nick Johnson, and I think his videos can get like too repetitive, but like I know him, he has this like focus where he shows like California like in decay, but it's kind of like a geography type like YouTube channel, and he'll go around and film the homeless encampments.
I've seen a lot of very interesting videos, and I mean, even just walking around the city myself.
It was pretty shocking. Like, maybe I seemed like I was downplaying it in my Substack articles, but I think right around the pandemic, when there was this dramatic increase in homeless encampments, it was pretty like seeing it for the first time, like that transformation in LA, in like LA or the Bay Area. It was pretty shocking because of how dramatically it happened, like right around the time of the pandemic.
Right. Yeah. And it is shocking. I mean, if anybody has never been to California and you know, go to LA and just drive around downtown LA, for example, you will see some of the most horrific sights imaginable. I mean, it's like literally talk about a third world country. I mean, you can go to downtown Los Angeles and you're living in a third world country, essentially, with all the homeless encampments and just crazy people walking around and many other parts of the city as well. And in other cities, but,
it used to be like just confined. It was mostly like downtown LA Skid Row. It is true. Like the homeless encampments are making inroads into like the wealthier areas, like the West Side. That is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So and there's a lot of other problems as well. But one thing I don't think a lot of people realize is that even in the 1980s, California was like over 80-85% white. And that has, you know, drastically changed, you know, in the 20-30 years since then. But what happened to the state? Where are all the white people going? What is going on there? I mean, you lived through it, so.
Yeah, I think now it's like 35%. I don't think it was I'm not sure what it was in the 80s. I actually think I'm not 100% sure. I think maybe in 1980 it may have been close to 70%. But the thing, like we talked about, like so, like white flight is an issue, and there's a lot of different issues, like just practical quality of life issues and like this constraint of housing supply. But I do think it is. I think one comment I got a comment on the Ron Owens. On the Owens Review article, and I think Ron Owens may have said this, is the sheer numbers, it looks really bad. And I'm probably going to save this like for another article, because I had a lot of different thoughts. And when you're running an article, you sort of edit stuff down, because I like to keep my word limit like 3,000 words maximum. I don't want it to be excessively long. But what's interesting is, so when you look at the change from a percentage basis, it does look pretty bad. but from a numerical basis, maybe like the peak in population was like 16 million, and it went down to like 14 million. So if you look at it on a on a numerical basis, maybe it isn't quite as bad on as a percentage basis. But actually, even with a lot of the pessimism, I think the big, most dramatic decline was actually, because I have, like, there's some chart that shows like the numerical decline. The biggest decline was actually in the 90s, and then into the 2000s, it was a more kind of a gradual, kind of like a more steep decline and like a more gradual decline. So maybe with like the pandemic and like the exodus, maybe it's gotten worse recently. I don't know, but it does seem. But just overall, I'd say like the looking at things on a numerical basis is actually not as bad as a percentage basis.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, I wanted to read just I have a couple excerpts here that I saved, and you write here in the article, you say, "While I am sympathetic to dissonant right concerns about demographics, they often are over-sensationalize racial problems to appear worse than they actually are. To the degree that there is anti-whiteness in California, it is more on an institutional level, such as tech censorship, anti-white discrimination in university admissions, and woke corporations, as well as state policies such as UBI for black birthing and proposed reparations, despite California never being a slave state." And then you say, "The main issues impacting white Californians are not so much overt racial hostilities, but rather practical issues such as the cost of housing and job security, and especially social atomization and a lack of community and identity." And you also make a point, you previously made it, that life in California is much closer to bowling alone than American History X. So I agree. I mean, after living there for the 12 years that I did, I mean, that I think that more or less accurately describes the situation.
Yeah, because I think some of the, I got a comment either on Unz or Twitter saying that like I was apologetic for all these bad things that were happening on an institutional level. But no, I'm just putting forth the reality. Because if you just go out in public and you see people interacting of different backgrounds, like, it is atomized, but there's still some sense of civility. I mean, there's like some, we did have like the riots in 2020, but overall there's a sense that people are pretty civil and people are just focused on their work, day-to-day lives, and people are coexisting. Like, you don't really sense any kind of like overt hostility, but it is absolutely true. Like, these radical like type policies, discriminatory policies, are taking a hold on an institutional level. So, I mean, that's the reality, but I think because of the way I worded things in a more nuanced sense, like some of the more right-wing people, they accuse me of saying, of being apologetic for the way things are, which is absurd. And yeah, and the thing is,
I didn't read it as, you know, you being apologetic for these things.
You're of course not.
Yeah, you're just factually observing what's going on. And I mean, again, you have direct experience living there, growing up there. Most people, like I mentioned, that comment about California have never even been to the state.
Yeah, it's like California it's what California symbolizes. It's not actually the reality. And yeah, it just symbolizes some, like, to them, just like it's a symbol of like a leftist dystopia, but it's not grounded in actually living here in day-to-day life.
One thing is clear, though, is that and you make this point, you know, at the institutional level, at the government level, like, the whole state is just run by like these totally radical leftists, woke, you know, these woke people, very anti-white, very Marxist. I mean, it's all LGBT this, and, you know, we need more immigration and reparations for blacks. So in that sense, it is absolutely true. But again, in my experience, most people are not like that, and they really don't even know what's going on politically. You know, you have, of course, your activist class, like you have anywhere, but generally speaking, my experience in California is most people are hardworking, productive. That, you know, there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of people that are pursuing, you know, side businesses, and they're setting up their own photography studio, or they're brewing beer, or they're doing this or doing that, you know. So there's a lot going on, and it seemed, at least in my experience, most people are sort of disconnected from this, like, woke, these, like, woke politics that dominate the state, which is very sad because, I mean,
yeah,
you know, that is the people running the state.
It doesn't need the majority of people. Like, even if you have ordinary people across all demographic backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, who are pretty just normal, reasonable people, that doesn't matter, because like a small minority with really insane policies can hijack the whole system.
Yeah, and that's certainly what's happened, it seems like. And I mean, even to a lesser extent, much of the country at this point, at least the Democratic Party. One other interesting aspect of the article, you know, you argue that California has transitioned into a state where Latinos largely form the working class, while Asians and to a lesser extent whites compromise the professional or like the managerial class. And I thought that was a very, very interesting commentary. I mean, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it is basically my experience as well working there. And although I do have to say I had much less
for the people like who got like displaced, it's obviously bad. But from the standpoint of just creating a functional society with a decent economy, I mean, that the model actually has actually worked out from that standpoint. Obviously,
yeah.
For people who have been pushed out and displaced, it's obviously bad, but it still creates a pretty functional society, because like, I think a good example, I point out like the city of like San Jose is it's mostly Asian Latino city. Maybe the white population is down to something like abysmally low, like maybe down to a quarter, but it's actually at the same time it has like a pretty like a high GDP per capita, and it has one of the lowest crime rates of any major city, and it's also like heavily immigrant. So for people who were maybe who got displaced, and it was obviously not great, but obviously it's not like to say this, it's a disaster. It's still like a relatively like functional place, never prosperous,
yeah.
Like the lowest crime and the high and a fairly high like GDP. So I'm not like some people maybe would get offended on the right would get offended by, well, I mean, the left would be for different reasons, but like right wingers would say I'm apologetic for the way things are, but I am saying like by just those metrics, it depends like what your metrics are, like what your values are, but by those metrics, then yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you make the point that it's sort of naive to assume, as you know, a lot of the dissident right would, that a non-white America is just going to collapse into dysfunction and you know outrageous crime. And sure, there are problems for sure. There is, you know, a rising crime rate. And there, you know, all sorts of economic problems, but overall, the state is still.
I am critical of the kind of like collapse porn narratives, but I mean, there are, like, there is an economic crisis. There are legitimate arguments of, like, you even have like these like more kind of like libertarian YouTubers saying there's going to be economic collapse. So, I mean, I have no idea how bad things will get with the economy, but there are legitimately like major problems, and there's like the political polarization becoming more and more extreme. But I guess specifically the one narrative, like to say that, though on the demographic angle, to say that it would automatically collapse, like you can say that you can criticize it, say it's a negative trend, but it's obviously, I think that's kind of like the problem with like the right wing, is they're so emotionally and politically invested in these specific narratives, and that things are going to work out a specific way. And I think, yeah, like sometimes there may be like some truth to that, but I think it's like a major flaw with the right. I think another major flaw with the right is they're always expecting like some major like backlash, because like one interesting thing is like right now we have like this massive like migrant crisis, but it actually had like no impact on the midterms. Like Republicans did pathetically. Like the right wing thinks that there's going to be there's going to be like some major backlash, but that doesn't always like work out that way.
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, I think you're right. And I mean, what you describe is, like I said, basically my experience working in the state, although I did have much less experience in contact with the Asian population than I'm sure, you know, others do or would. I mean, especially, you know, in Northern California, I think the Asian population is much greater. But I mean, overall, a lot of the non-white population is actually hardworking and ambitious and productive. And I really didn't experience all that many racial conflicts in the workplace or just, you know, in society in general. One thing I did notice, though, is that there's like this seeming sense of maybe like jealousy or I think maybe a better word would be like resentment of certain minorities towards whites. And this is something you could probably experience anywhere in the country, but it's something I definitely noticed in California. And I think a lot of this has to do with just the way whites are demonized in the media and in the history books. And like the total like just weaponization of the historical record and the role that whites have played in this country and in the state of California particularly.
Another point I made. So I did say that things are pretty affable. People coexist, people get along okay. But the thing is, like, because of the amount of demonization that's being pushed in education at an early age now, like that could flip in the future. So I was interesting what I do in this article is I don't push one explicit narrative. I think there are different like possible scenarios that could happen. Like I take that into account because yeah, like that because of the amount of like indoctrination, that could shift things dramatically in the future with like younger generations. So then the other thing is as income inequality and economic problems, like more jobs will be automated and we're going to economic crisis, that puts stress on people. I mean, that could exacerbate and make race relations much worse. So I think it's important, like, not to be invested in one narrative, but at the same time, like, many different possible scenarios could happen. So it's like I talk about something like pan-enclavism, but maybe I do this, like, myself. Like, but who knows, like, maybe that doesn't necessarily pan out is like I write about, so I see that as a trend. I think it's important is just to look at different because I would say I would actually say that I think of myself like more as like a trend forecaster. My main interest is in like predicting future trends is probably like what my main political and sociological interest.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. So I know we only got about 15 minutes left, and there's a couple other aspects of the article I want to get to. One of which is you talk about the rootlessness of white Californians in particular, which is very, very interesting to me. You argue that California is uniquely rootless, which is exacerbated by the high cost of living. White Californians in particular are uniquely individualistic, perhaps one of the most individualistic groups of people on earth, making them disproportionately impacted by atomization for those who aren't connected to a close-knit community. And that is something, again, I experienced firsthand in California is whites especially are very, very rootless. And I mean, I myself was sort of part of this. Yeah, you know, I moved across the country to live there.
Things have changed so dramatically, but I think even like these past areas that are kind of idealized, like the 50s, I think that kind of individualism was baked in the cake in California already, just because of the way things were set up. California was set up by a variety of diverse assortment of these like transplants from all over. And then like these like new kind of suburban subdivisions were built up in the 50s, and it kind of created a more kind of deracinated identity. So I think even when you could say this window where California was maybe more homogenous or more, like we're kind of in a post-American era, but even when it was more quote unquote American, these issues were basically kind of solidified this individualism. And also the way like the kind of the urban planning model is the whole idea of coming out to California so you can have like a home with like a large backyard is very like you can idealize that and say it was great at the time, but it was sort of built up for like hyper individualism. So Yeah, I don't. There's a whole other angle with like the housing policies, which I don't think we have time for to go into that in depth. But I do think the way people live is the way. So right now we have like a housing crisis, but that kind of model was very kind of like hyper individualistic, and I think in the East, I mean the East Coast has a lot of the same problems, but maybe in comparison, maybe it's more communitarian because you have people who have like lived in the same area for a longer period of time for over generations.
Absolutely.
You also have, I think, like walkable, like things like walkable communities, which it's actually the left has generally been like more supportive of, but things like walkable communities are really crucial for like social capital and building up any sense of like community or identity.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, the East Coast, I have lived on the East Coast and traveled quite a bit on the East Coast, and it is very much more tight-knit communities, extended families and friends and stuff versus California. There is that to a certain extent. I mean, especially if you're from the state and you have a network of family and friends and stuff, but there's just so many people coming and going in California all the time. You know, people come in and they'll live there for a year or two and then leave. So yeah, it's a very unique place in that regard. And I think this rootlessness, also impacts other white demographics around the country. Just in general, whites have not developed a positive, like, pro-white racial community that seeks to champion our own unique interests.
Attached to Americanism, that's the thing.
So, sorry, say that one more time.
I think it's very much attached to, like, Americanism. So this is a quote. This is from, I think, another article. So traditionally, like, Americanism and whiteness have been inherently kind of attached together. And I think going into like the future of a more like multicultural America, I kind of see like two scenarios. So like either I said in like a previous article, either whiteness and Americanism will eventually be decoupled. So either you'll see a kind of like civic nationalist American identity that is decoupled from whiteness, or you'll see like whiteness as part of multiculturalism. Like it's either one or the other, but the thing is like you can't underestimate how connected and invested people are into Americanism. And like, what Americanism, like, what does it mean at this point? Like, now I think it's pretty clear, like, we're in a, like a post-American society, and America just exists as like an economic zone. But despite that, like, so many people, like, they won't, I mean, especially older generations, but this impacts younger people too. But they're so invested in Americanism, and it's like, maybe you could say it's a cope, but it's just something, it's just so ingrained in the culture that people are not, it's very difficult for people to let go of.
And yeah,
like,
the
question is like, what at this point, like, how do you define Americanism?
Right, yeah, I mean, you know, you'd ask 10 people that question, and you'd get 10 different answers. So yeah, no, it is a problem. I think this really though impacts whites especially, given the fact that the mass media and the government work tirelessly specifically to prevent, you know, whites from having their own positive racial identity. I mean, that to me is a huge problem. That basically is the problem for whites in America. We're the only group not allowed, let alone
like,
encouraged.
If it was framed as multiculturalism rather than nationalism, the question is like, would that expand the Overton window? I think that is the way to go. But the thing is, it's not going. You can maybe win over more people. I think it's a smart strategy, but it's not going to stop. Like I kind of at the beginning of the show, I joked. I said like I'm a centrist and a multiculturalist, so you can't say that's racist. But the thing is, with the left, anything that's like any kind of positive identity politics is still going to be like viciously attacked by the other side. Like that's not something you can really get around, and that has to be kind of addressed. But still, it's better to pursue it for multiculturalism than nationalism.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. So there's two last things here, real quick. You talk about white flight in the article, of course, and that's something we've been talking about throughout this conversation. And at the end of the article, you kind of talk about how whites who do stay in California will be more resilient and strong and sort of able to overcome various challenges and institutional obstacles
that are thrown their way.
Yeah.
There was a conservative Trump supporter who left the state who got really offended by that. But I guess to clarify, by resilient can be like subjective and open to interpretation. But I guess by resilient, I mean adapted to California. So, like, I guess it is. Yeah, I mean, it is open to interpretation. But it's like you have these people, more conservative people leaving, and then you have like the more kind of like individualistic, atomized people who maybe will stay, but they don't really, as a demographic sense, they don't really have a future. So there is this kind of niche of people who are more resilient. And to be kind of frank, it is more of a class thing. Like, it is more of an upper class group, but going beyond just economics, like, it's starting to become more like a tribe or caste of people.
Yeah, and that's what I had highlighted. You say in the article that you expect this niche group of affluent white Californians with healthy fertility to increasingly become their own caste in the future. Yeah, very interesting.
I think they sort of already are, but it's more on an implicit level. I definitely see that coming in. I think another thing, I didn't really address. This is something that I don't think I really addressed, but I do think like wokeness and the way like issues like race relations are discussed are based on kind of like America's history of black and white relations. But that's actually, that sort of reflects the past. That doesn't really like reflect the future.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, and then one last thing here. This is basically how you close the essay, at least partially. You say, whites must adapt to thrive as a tribe in the inevitable multicultural future. The sooner whites adapt, the better, but the danger is that whites wait too long to adapt. And that really kind of goes to the heart of all this. I mean, the way I look at America, it's basically a multiracial like empire at this point, and there's all these different competing groups, and whites are the only ones that aren't competing.
I gave like India as an example, where you just have all these like kind of tribes and castes, and it's kind of, but also kind of like quasi decentralized. And I think like the right wing may view that in a kind of dystopian sense, but actually I think that combined with like centralized institutions that forbade freedom of association, that would be terrible, or you can even say dystopian. But I'd say with a kind of like radically decentralized political or economic system, like, I actually don't see it as a bad thing. I think there actually are positive things. I'd say like even things to be optimistic about. Things to be optimistic about. I think what's really kind of what's pretty like depressing or terrible is this kind of like limbo or in between stage. I think like letting go and actually embracing that is actually, I'd say, is something to be optimistic about. I would actually not say like this article or the theme in general is a pessimistic or reactionary subject matter. It's forward thinking.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, man. I think it's very interesting. It's very unique. It's a very interesting take on Californian politics that I haven't encountered anywhere else. So I think you're doing a great job, and you got a lot of really good insight. So keep up the good work, man. I'm glad to connect with you. When I post this podcast, I'll have a link over to your Twitter page where I follow you on Twitter, and then, of course, to your Substack page, and I'll also put a link to your author page at the UNS Review.
Where is this going to be posted?
I'll post it on my website.
Okay, great.
Yeah, and I'll send you a link to it once it's up here in a few minutes.
Okay, great. Take care.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.